You know, I didn't start off as this radical Jesus freak, only to end up as a petulant Republican with a Jesus fish on his SUV. And so I thought, okay, I've got to save my soul, if you know what I mean by that. I mean, not get my ticket to heaven, but I mean, become who I'm supposed to be.
Well, friends, the esteemed Brian Zond is with us on the podcast today, and he does not mess around, does he? We're going to have a lot of fun with Brian here. He shares with us about Easter eggs that you can kind of find in his books, particularly Easter eggs around songs and other things from other pieces of literature. We talk a little bit about the Camino Santiago and that trek and what it's meant for him. Talk about remodeling your theological house and even the language that's often being used in sort of the larger conversation around that is deconstruction. And so we talk a bit about that and what that word, where it actually comes from and what it actually originally has meant. Those of you that are pastors that are going through your own sort of like faith remodeling, we talk a bit about that. But what does it look like to lead through that? Should you lead through that? How do you take churches through that journey with you? Do you take churches through that journey with you? I think it's a really important and interesting conversation. And where we end up is we end up talking a bit about contemplative prayer and formative prayer. And I'll just tell you right at the get-go, I did not want us to just talk about that without having some sort of experience of that. So I actually asked Brian at the end of our time together to lead us through a prayer, like a prayer. It's a prayer that he uses every day to sort of set up his contemplative practice, what he calls sitting with Jesus. And so you get just a little taste of his prayer schools. So just a couple of quick plugs for Brian before we get into it. He mentions briefly that they have a prayer school out at his church in Missouri. They actually have created an online experience of that that's coming up in February. So we'll put links to it in the show notes. And then his newest book, we talk a bit about as well. It's called When Everything's on Fire. And I can't recommend it highly enough. I think you are going to enjoy our time here with Brian. So I'll throw it over to that interview. Well, friends, welcome back to the podcast. Brian Zond is with us. And Brian, I am so stoked to have you here. You are a man of many passions and gifts and interests. And like your bio talks about founding Word of Life Church, and you all just celebrated, is it your 40th anniversary?
40th anniversary, yeah.
Which is amazing. And so I want to talk a little bit about leadership and some of your own journey and how you lead a church. But you are a prolific author as well. Your newest book that we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about is When Everything's on Fire. And genuinely, I think like I've read almost all your books. And I think like, I mean, this is a huge compliment. Everyone gets better and better. I just appreciate the work that you're putting out. So while you're known for those things, the thing that I always think of with you, whenever I'm talking about you in my home and I'll mention you, you came out to the church that I was leading out here in Long Beach and led a prayer school for us and did some other things as well. And my daughter, who I think was probably like 11 at the time, came with me to pick you up at the airport. And whenever I mention you, I say, you remember the guy who, he quoted Bob Dylan lyrics to us for like 20 minutes from memory. And she's like, oh, yeah, I know him.
Yeah, I have a lot of, I have a couple of canonical texts. One of them is Dylan lyrics. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's how you're known in the Goldsworthy household. That's fine with me.
That is just fine with me.
And I don't think, did you quote Bob Dylan in your newest book?
Yes. Yes, I do. A couple of times.
Okay.
I mean, I at least once attribute it, but there's at least, and then there's also, I usually do this once. I usually will just steal a line that doesn't rhyme. I'll just take a bit of it and drop it in. Just, I don't know.
Okay.
For fun.
If
you don't really know your Dylan, you won't catch it. You'll think it's just good writing. but I've stolen it. And but my friends that are really hardcore Dylan fans, you know, they'll just get a little smile and go, oh, I see what you did there. It's a fun.
Yeah, I like that.
I can't remember what it is, what line it is I stole. I can't remember, but I know I did.
All right. Well, if it comes up, like, just blurt it out at some point here. So when everything's on fire, what was...
I remembered it. I described David as, okay, I got to get it, the righteous king who wrote psalms beside moonlit streams. Isn't that a lovely line? But that's... It's from the song I and I by Bob Dylan. The righteous king who wrote psalms beside moonlit streams.
I love that. I love that there's Dylan Easter eggs. Are there other kinds of Easter eggs in your books, or is it just Dylan?
Well, you really want to know? I will tell you.
Yeah.
I will tell you. The title... Can we just start by mixing the Camino and the book, and I'll tell you this story all together. Can we just start that way?
Yeah, please. Yeah, we right, were so chatting about the Camino before from. We started recording.
Because before you started recording, you were asking me about the Camino. Well, Perry and I have walked the Camino de Santiago 3 times, twice on the Francis route, once on the Portuguese route. We were walking in 2019, the Francis route, for our second time. And when you walk the Camino, it is a little bit like a time machine. I mean, you really do get a feel for what life was like in the medieval period, just because you're around so many old churches and monasteries and things like that. And so I was walking, you know, you have a lot of time to think. I mean, that's part of why you walk something like the Camino, this 500-mile pilgrimage route across northern Spain, if people don't know what we're talking about. Part of the reason you do that is you can really bring your soul into a contemplative state. You just have a lot of time to think, muse, not think like we usually do with darting all around, but just maybe settle into something. And I was very cognizant of how, well, that faith is not a given anymore, that it's not presumed, that we live in a secular age. And when I use the word secular, I'm always afraid people are going to hear me use that in culture war terms. I don't mean it like that. I just mean philosophically, we live in a time where faith is pushed to the periphery and in danger of being pushed right off the cliff. And so I was thinking about, you know, this is fairly new as far as, you know, the history of humanity. And we are facing unique challenges. And I thought, well, what would I want to say to people that were maybe in danger of losing faith in a secular age? And so I was thinking along those lines. And about 200 miles, 2 weeks into our long pilgrimage, we were at Castro Juarez. It's a really lovely hilltop village. And we walked about 15 miles or something like that day. And we'd gotten settled in, and I was just sitting outside where we were staying on this kind of terrace. And I thought, well, what would I want to say? And I outlined the book, and it really stuck to it. I had 11 chapters, and I gave it this title. Originally, it was entitled, What Can We Do When Everything's on Fire? The publisher, I think, wisely wanted to shorten it down to When Everything's on Fire, which was fine with me. But here's what you don't know. And that was in fall of 2019. And then we could talk about how by the time we got into March of 2020, everything was on fire. But I'd already given it the title to begin with, What Can We Do When Everything's on Fire? And then it gets shortened up, When Everything's on Fire. But I stole that title too. It's from Antonio Lobo Antunes, who no one's heard of. I mean, he's a Portuguese novelist that actually is well-known in really elite literary circles and in Portugal, but not outside. I discovered him traveling in Portugal, and I've read many of his novels, of course, in English translation, and one of them is entitled, What Can I Do When Everything's on Fire? And it's an inscrutable stream of conscious novel that, that I would not recommend. It's very strange, very difficult, but I always liked the title. And so as a tribute to Antonio Lobo Antunes, I lifted one line from his novel and put it in my book. Not plagiarism, but tribute, you know. I mean, in fact, the book is dedicated. I mean, he's mentioned in the dedication. The Antonio, for Antonio, is Antonio Lobo Atunich. But I use this line. Let me get it right. I got to think of it. Lonely people who lost their ideals 35 years ago and can only now put a touch of a smile over a mask of pain. What a great line. And that's actually from Antonio.
That's so good.
That was a little rambling story, but okay.
No, I appreciate like the way that you get to make you often will make a point by telling a larger story to get that, and it like sits differently and it kind of hits you differently. It's something I've noticed in your preaching that I've come to really appreciate, that giving the origin of a thing and the way that you do it. In fact, you tell this story in the book that you told in a talk that you gave when you came out here about the day that Derrida died. Mm-hmm. And like that line just would always like click with me, the day that Derrida died.
Yeah.
And so giving like that larger sort of context, I felt like, yeah, it's just a helpful preaching trick that I've seen you do. It feels like a good chunk of your book is dealing with what's kind of colloquially being called like deconstruction, right? Reconstruction, yeah, of faith right now. And I know, or at least previously, you had told me that wasn't your favorite term. I had asked you to come out and talk about that with our church, and you're like, I'll talk about water to wine. I don't like to talk about deconstruction. And then you use another metaphor in this book that I really liked. Beyond your water to wine, you talked about your theological house being remodeled. Do you mind talking about like that picture?
Yeah, let me first say something about deconstruction.
Please.
I have my own story of this, and that's what I tell in the book that is somewhat memoirish, Water to Wine. I had that experience beginning in 2004, before the term deconstruction was in vogue. Deconstruction comes to us from Jacques Derrida. I mean, that's where it comes from. He is the founder of deconstruction theory, which has to do with how we read texts and alerting us that a text has no final or fixed meaning or interpretation, and that behind the text there are often hidden agendas, often bids for power, things like that. And he's talking about deconstructing the text. It's not my favorite term to use for a critical reevaluation of Christian faith and theology, but it's so in vogue that I use it. I mean, the second chapter, though, is entitled Deconstructing Deconstruction, which is what I do in that chapter. I mean, okay, what do we mean here? And I talk about what Derrida is up to. But it's not my favorite term because it sounds a little too violent.
Yes.
Deconstruction can very easily be just destruction. And, you know, any fool can destroy something, right? I mean, it takes great skill to whatever, to build some noble edifice, but, you know, any fool with a sledgehammer can tear it down. So one of the metaphors, I have several, but one of them I go for is I talk about your theological house. And you have to make a distinction between Christ the King and the place that Christ the King occupies in your mind, in your thinking, in your words, in your speech. So by theological house, I mean, I could just say, I mean your theology, but I want to work with a metaphor. And I say, your theological house is the palace of Christ the King in your mind. It's how we think about God and speak about God as revealed in Christ. But your theological house is not one thing. It's not a tiny one-room bungalow. It's a sprawling mansion with dozens of rooms. And how it comes to be is very complex. Some of it you inherit, you grow up with. Some of it just is given to you by whatever particular Christian tradition you're a part of. It's the books you read. It's, you know, it just comes by various ways. Well, to tell my own story, you know, I had a very dramatic encounter with Jesus as a teenager. Overnight, I go from being the high school Zeppelin freak to the high school Jesus freak, although I still like Zeppelin. And so that's how I get started. And then along the way, I'm constructing, it's inevitable, my theological house. Some of it comes from the Jesus movement. Some of it from the Baptist church that I grew up in as a kid. Some of it comes from the charismatic movement that was happening at that time. So, and it just comes from wherever it came from, whatever teachers have influenced me and whatever books I've read and seem to assimilate. But by the time I was entering my 40s, and then, well, it began when I was about 40. And then by the time I was 45, or as I like to say, halfway to 90, because that'll scare you, I realized that I was embarrassed by my theological house, that I was still fascinated by Christ the King, the person of Jesus who came unbidden almost, crashing into my life when I was a teenager. I maintained my love and fascination for Jesus, but I was embarrassed because there were things that were tawdry. There were things that were unbecoming, things that lacked the beauty of Christ. Things maybe about how I understood eternal judgment, how I understood atonement, eschatology. Whew, that was a bad one. And I realized I was embarrassed. And so what I had to do, I just said, okay, not that I used the metaphor at that time, but I'm saying I've got to renovate my theological house. I've got to remodel.
Yeah, yeah.
And if anybody's ever remodeled a house while living in it, you know how inconvenient that is and how it's, you know, if you know, you know, it's going to take longer than you think. It's going to cost more than you think. And that was very true in my case. Now, because my theological house was not one thing, but many things with many rooms, I mean, the whole thing didn't have to be destroyed, or I didn't have to, you know, bring in a wrecking ball and just tear it all down. Some rooms were largely untouched. Other rooms were significantly remodeled. And then I had one wing, a whole wing called my eschatology. And maybe deconstruction is a pretty appropriate term for that, because that pretty much, we didn't remodel it. We didn't take it down to the studs. We took it down to the foundation. And that's simply because, you know, I come from the Jesus movement, and I look back with fondness upon the Jesus movement. I think it was aptly named because it was very much centered around Jesus, and there are things that were good and pure about it, but it had a horrible eschatology. You know, it was all this, you know, left behind, and what was before left behind. It was late great planet Earth and all that just nonsense. Yep. And so, yes, that had to be, okay, deconstructed, renovated. But here's the thing. Within certain strands of evangelicalism, and especially as it tilts toward fundamentalism, people have tied their entire theology together in one bundle so tightly that, let's say, for example, somebody begins to rethink how they understand hell. You know, does God operate in eternal torture? And they find that one narrow concept of understanding what we mean by hell, which is a very complex subject, untenable. Well, then all of a sudden, I can't be a Christian anymore. And they throw everything out. And what they've done is, in rejecting Christian fundamentalism, what they've actually done is reject Christianity, but maintain or retain fundamentalism. They're still a fundamentalist. They're just no longer a Christian. And so I would suggest that we find ways to reverse that. Get rid of the fundamentalism, keep Christ.
Yeah.
And thinking of your theology not as one thing, but as a theological house that needs renovation, but maybe not everything needs to be renovated. Some things are probably just fine. So that's one metaphor I use in the book.
Yeah, and sure. And I like the house idea too, because it's all sort of like interconnected in some ways. And you don't even realize how it's all interconnected. You think you're working on plumbing in your kitchen, and it opens up all these new problems somewhere else that you weren't even expecting.
It's very true.
I think similar to you, Dallas Willard's Divine Conspiracy messed me up when I first read it.
That was my gateway drug.
Took me 18 months to read it the first time. Like, I just didn't know how to read Willard. I eventually got the study guide that went with it. And then finally got through it. And then I try to reread it about every year and a half or so. And the thing, like, that caused me to rethink the way I understood Kingdom of God and what Jesus's yep. mission and work was doing, which then for me, I had been surrounded by dispensational premillennialism. Yep. And so it like started pushing on that I had to, but that was really like for me a clear intellectual connection. But then there began to be things like you bring up eternal conscious torment and the way that we think about hell that didn't start from that same sort of place, but maybe from like philosophical questions yeah. or something like, but they all in some sort of way maybe were intermeshed, but it wasn't this like linear sort of process.
Right. So, I mean, I'm saying I have my own experience with in midlife, a critical reevaluation of my theology and making changes quite publicly because I was a pastor of a church. And so,
yeah,
you know, I mean, you can, if you're not a public figure, you can change your theology and nobody knows unless you choose to tell people. If you are a pastor, you know, people are going to figure out pretty quick that things are changing. So,
yes.
So I know what it's like to do that. I did it at great cost. It was worth it, but it was still at great cost. But I didn't ever use the word deconstruction. My go-to was water to wine. I also mm-hmm. talk about, imagine that a precious icon is found in some monastery in Russia. Maybe it's an icon of Christ. Maybe it's 1,000 years old, and it had been maybe lost or it was just in some corner. And it's now covered with a patina of grime and soot and dirt so that the image of Christ is nearly obscured. Well, what do? Do you throw it away? No, you don't throw it away. What you do is you bring in a restoration artist who is going to recover the image, bring it back to as it was intended to be. Now, whatever tools the restoration artist may have in her, you know, toolkit, you're not going to find dynamite and sledgehammers. So, I don't think this is something that if it can be avoided. I mean, who am I to tell people what to do? All right, but if it can be avoided, try not to go through this process with a lot of anger and a lot of reaction. Try to do it cool-headed. Try to do it being gracious to those, because those that gave you the faith that may have probably in good faith passed along some bad theology, they were just passing on what they had received, but they probably also passed on some good things too. And so maybe they had some ideas about hell and about other subjects that you just find abhorrent today. Got it. Fine. But they also probably, unless you grew up in some abusive cult, they probably also taught you about a Jesus who loves and forgives sinners and welcomes all who come to him. And so I don't think we need to simply focus on, okay, they taught me about eternal conscious torment and they maybe manipulated some things to make God scary so that I would stay in line. Okay, let's change that. Let's deal with that. But they probably also gave you some good. They probably gave you John 3:16 as well, that God loves the world. And
yeah,
so you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, and it's not even just that there's some good within it that they gave you. It's also like, I think some of the stuff that you had to process and work through, you only came to the place where you were because you had inherited some of that right. stuff. And so if we're not talking about like things that are actually trauma, creating trauma for you, but that were maybe difficult theologies, things that like you had to wrestle through later on, in some ways, those things were gifts, even if you ended up having to discard those things because they brought you to the place where you are now.
Exactly. It was the beauty of Christ that led to your, whatever you want to call it, deconstruction, reevaluation.
Yeah.
Here's a quote that's not in the book, because I found it. I read a lot of Rene Girard, but somehow this one had eluded me because he wrote quite a bit. But I came across this after the book was written. Rene Girard, you know, so great at just little pithy quotes. He says, Voltaire and his successors only criticize Christianity with Christianity. I thought that was so great.
Yeah.
That Voltaire.
Hey, talk to me about that. Unpack that a bit.
Okay. If you listen to those that critique Christianity, they are usually using an assumed value base that they actually inherit from Christianity to do so. So that in essence, their critique of Christianity is that it's simply not Christian enough, to which I think we ought to say, amen.
Yes. Yes. And amen. Yeah. So you mentioned you were pastoring through this sort of experience that you're having. I was as well, which was a part of why maybe I started resonating with what you were writing pretty early on. And for me, I don't think I fully understood what all I was going through, probably partly because of my age at the time and because of some self-imposed pressures that I had created. But when I started going through the process of preparing to step out of the church that I was leading, the elders had brought in a consultant who did some focus groups in the church and spent some time with me. And at one point, the consultant said to me, she goes, "I would imagine that you're incredibly anxious." And I was having some panic attacks. I was really anxious. And I said, "Like, I am. Like, why would you say that, though?" And she said, "It seems to me, as I'm talking to your church and getting to know them, who you are and who the church is are two different people. And in order for you to have been leading this church as long as you have been, you are probably not showing up as your full self. And so you're holding that in, and that's creating anxiety in you." And it named this thing that was so helpful. For it seems to me from the outside, and I might be projecting onto you, but that seems to be a different experience from you. It seems to me you didn't hold it in, that you took your church on a journey with you. Is that fair?
Let me about that a little bit.
I would love to. Yeah.
So I'm trying to think how I can just sum this up fairly quickly. So, you know, from the Jesus movement, and I accidentally started church. I didn't even start a church. What happened was there was a thing in St. Joseph called the Catacombs, and it was mostly a music venue for the Jesus music scene that originally met in the basement of a dive bar on 3rd Street. We called it the Catacombs because it was a double entendre. You know, we felt this connection with early Christianity, but it was also in this dingy basement, you know. So, and by the time I was 17, I was leading it, all right? And it was mostly a music venue, but it began to be more and more like a church. And so there were nights when we didn't have a music act and I would teach or something like that. And by the time I was 22, everybody just kind of recognized, you know, this is turning into a church. And so we just took the leap and started meeting on Sundays and called it Word of Life Church. And that was 40 years ago. Then what happens, though, is over time, you know, one thing leads to another. So the Jesus movement led me to the charismatic movement, which I describe as good until it wasn't. But then that led to other things, and the charismatic movement kind of leads to Word of Faith. Word of Faith kind of leads to religious right and all of that sort of stuff. And that's what led to the crisis in my 40s that I woke up and I thought, how did I get here? How did I get here? It's like I got on the wrong bus somewhere. You know, I didn't start off as this radical Jesus freak only to end up as a petulant Republican with a Jesus fish on his SUV. And so I thought, okay, I've got to save my soul, if you know what I mean by that. I mean, not get my ticket to heaven, but I mean, become who I'm supposed to be. I remember at that time I was reading a lot of Kierkegaard, and there's a Kierkegaard line where he says, "Now by the help of God, I shall become myself." And I began to say that a lot. That was a part of my, "Now by the help of God, I shall become myself." Now, here's where it's a little different. One day I was sitting on my front step. This was early on. And I was sitting on my front step, and I was reading Augustine's Confessions. And I was moved by the sincerity and devotion of this man who really had everything. He was essentially a speechwriter for the emperor. He had power, wealth, influence, the girls. That was a big thing for him. And he gives his life to Christ. And he goes a different direction, and he's devoted. And I was moved by that. And I prayed, and I said, "God," I said, "as much as I can mean anything, in this moment, I mean this. I want to spend the rest of my life knowing you as you are revealed in Christ. And when I said that, when I prayed that, I had this strange, it was really mystical, this strange experience of just wanting to say to people, come with me, come with me, come with me and you won't get cheated. Come with me and you won't get cheated. And I had this compulsion that I was going to be moving into a new place, which I was, in Christ, in God, theologically. But I wasn't to go alone. I was to try to bring my church with me, not leave my church and go do my own thing, or which I could have done, but bring this congregation with me. Now, I need to clarify something. I was in a unique position in that I was the founding pastor of a non-denominational church with decades of experience. At this time, you know, over 20 years. And so I had a lot of equity. And I at least had the opportunity to try. I wasn't going to get fired. There wasn't going to be a bishop come sweeping in and say, Zahn, you can't do this. I had the opportunity to try. A lot of pastors don't have that opportunity. I did. Mm-hmm. Now, I could have wrecked the whole thing. I could have, you know, I mean, if enough people said, no, we're not coming with you, then the thing just would have no longer been feasible. But I felt like I was supposed to, and there were people that, you know, probably to this day, I think maybe less so now, but there was a time, I think, when people were quite angry that left because they felt like I changed the what they'd signed up for, which I say true enough.
That's fair, right?
In that if you joined Word of Life, let's say in 1991, where we were going was not that. On the other hand, you know, so we just crossed 40 years. So there was a lot of looking back and reminiscing and all of that. And one of the things I noticed was you can find, because, you know, all my sermons, they're all recorded, right? So there they are. I have all my sermon notes for sure, which is over 4 million words of sermon notes, 3,606. And
the fact that you know that.
Yeah, I do. And you could show a clip of me preaching, and let's say circa 1993, that would embarrass me, but it wouldn't shame me. I would be embarrassed. I would cringe, go, oh, you know, I don't believe that anymore. I'm smarter than that now. But what I did then, I always did in good faith. It was always coming from trying to follow Jesus the best I can.
Yes.
And so if I look back on my 30-year-old self, I'm 62 now, I was making 31, half a lifetime ago. If I look on my 31-year-old self preaching, maybe I'm a little bit embarrassed, but also there is compassion on that. Because when you're 62, you look at your 31-year-old self, and it's like a different person. And I look at that person, and I just say, he just needs more time. He'll be all right. Just give him some more time. And so if you joined Word of Life thinking, okay, we're going to be a kind of a charismatic Word of Faith church, 90s style, and that's what you're committed to, then, yeah, you might have been upset post-2004 and all. But if you said, what we're really about is following Jesus, wherever he goes, wherever he takes us, we're following Jesus, I never departed from that. So,
yeah. So it's kind of like the heart has stayed the same, but maybe like the specific directions or plan has changed, but the heart hasn't changed.
I mean, part of what happened, Mike, it's as simple as this. I don't know if I want to say it. I should say it because it's actually shows up in my Water to Wine book. I tell the story. So this all starts in 2004 with me. And in 2004, here's a Dylan thing. Dylan releases his very unique, very Dylan-esque memoir called Chronicles, for which he won a Pulitzer. It's very interesting. It's kind of different. But he tells a story about very early on, when he's maybe like 20 or 21, and he's left Minnesota. He's in New York. He was just starting out. He just kind of bounced around from place to place where people would just put up with him, you know, let him stay with him. But he was staying for a while with this kind of wealthy, literary, elite couple in New York. And he walks in, they had a library in their apartment, and he walks into this library and he describes it. and he flips on the light and he sees all of these books and he begins to browse and he looks at, you know, the various titles they have. And he says it just had a, I can't remember the language he used. He says something to the fact that it just exuded knowledge. But here's the exact line that I can quote. He said, "It was enough to make you lose your passion for dumbness." And this, I know this kid, this, I'm on thin ice here, but it helps me to say it like this. I reached a point where when it comes to Christian theology, I just lost my passion for dumbness. And I just decided I want to be a serious conversation partner in the ongoing conversation of God as revealed in Christ that is Christian theology. But there is a price for admission if you want to be taken seriously. And the price for admission is to know basically what has already been said. And so I had to get up to speed. And I spent several years, and this will sound crazy, but it's true, reading hours a day, or mostly at night, actually, hours a night, every night. I mean, I didn't, from like 2004 to 2008, I didn't watch any television. I was reading theology, hardcore academic theology, and loving every second of it. Never seemed like work to me. Never seemed like I was being made to do it. It was more like I'd struck gold and couldn't pull it out of the ground fast enough. I kept thinking, where have you been all my life? And so I just got, because I say some things about the Jesus movement. I said, I remember it fondly. There's much of it that I'm glad that I have that in my roots. I'm glad that's where I came from. It's a good place to start. The Jesus movement and the early charismatic renewal. But it had its own, it was a revival movement. And as revival movements tend to be, it was rather anti-intellectual. And sure. Eventually that's going to hurt you. Eventually that's going to catch up with you if you're trying to be a leader. And I just decided I wasn't going to stay ignorant anymore. And so in one sense, you know, these changes in my life can be, some of them are fairly simple. I just decided that I was going to lose my passion for theological dumbness. And it started with Dallas Willard. It started with Dallas Willard. And you know, the story was, so what I originally started reading was, I just didn't know where to start. So I just started reading church fathers and philosophy because I always liked philosophy. And you know, that was viewed as odd. I mean, you may not know this, Mike, but most Word of Faith charismatic preachers don't read a lot of philosophy or church fathers. So I was reading all that and it was good, but I thought, you know, I need something contemporary. And I was just shockingly ignorant of the good stuff. I mean, I just didn't know. And so I didn't know. I'd never heard of any of these people that we all talk about now. And one day I prayed. I said, God, show me what to read. I prayed. I said, God, show me what to read. And like 2 minutes later, Perry walks in the room. She didn't know what I prayed. She just walks up to me, hands me a book. She says, here, I think you should read this. I had just prayed, God, show me what to read. My wife walks in 2 minutes later. Here, I think you should read this book. It gets stranger. Perry had not read this book. In fact, she found it in our house and has no idea how it got here. I didn't buy it. She didn't buy it. To this day, we don't know. But it was Dallas Willard's The Divine Conspiracy. And I didn't take, I mean, for me, my story is I didn't take 18 months to read it. I took, you know, a few days. I was like, oh my gosh. And then I just went on this.
Yeah, you're smarter.
One thing led to another. And then I find N.T. Wright and I read all of his stuff. And then I find Brueggemann and I read all of his stuff. And then I find, you know, one after another. I read Hauerwas, all of his stuff. Well, that's going to change you. Now, I was changing for the good. So when people would get mad and leave the church, sometimes they would say, you know, he's backslidden. I thought, that makes no sense to me at all. I feel like I have front slid. I feel like I've made a quantum leap forward in understanding God as revealed in Christ, and my commitment to follow him has never been stronger. And it was a time of deeply contradictory experiences. Perry was with me the whole time. I wasn't bringing Perry along. Perry wasn't bringing me. We were together. And yeah, we weren't necessarily reading the same things. I mean, we kind of have a division of labor when it comes to reading. I'll read more academic theology. She'll read other stuff. But we always just talk with each other. So we always, you know, benefit. And we were feeling like we've been looking for this all of our lives. I mean, we began with Jesus, but we needed better theology. Well, we're finding it. We needed a richer Christianity. We're finding it. So we were, it was thrilling. At the same time, we were being misunderstood, maligned, and rejected. And that was deeply, deeply, deeply painful. I mean, it was really painful. If anybody reads Water to Wine now, I think that book came out in 2015 or 16, something like that. I tell how painful it was, but not really. I underplayed it because I was still feeling the pain. Here's some more Camino stuff, Mike. We didn't necessarily go on the Camino in 2016, our first one, to get healed, because we didn't know. We were just, who knows why we were going. I mean, we had our reasons, but it was our first sabbatical. It was our first break in 35 years. I mean, I'd never missed more than two Sundays ever for 35 years. And so this was our first substantial break, but it healed our soul. We didn't know how wounded we are until we got healed. You know, sometimes people have been sick for a long time and they forgot what it was like to be well. You know, we were so wounded and hurt that we'd forgot what it was like not to be hurt. But that long, I mean, that's why the communion will always be beloved to us, because it healed our, that 40-day walk, that's how long it took us anyway, across the 500 miles, it healed our souls. And we came back. I mean, we quite literally talk about our lives, both pre and post 2004. That's when we began that journey, and pre and post our first Camino in 2016 that healed our souls. Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious in hearing you talk about your experience, both as a kind of intellectual journey and as a contemplative journey. Yeah. That'd be fair to say. Sure. That the Camino is a contemplative
journey. Well, I learned
how
to pray during that time too.
Hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I want to talk about that also. I'm curious what your advice would be for pastors who are pastoring a church and they are starting to experience their own sort of theological remodeling, and they're trying to figure out, how do I preach through this? What do I do? What do I take my church through? What do I keep just for me? What are the implications for my church? What should I be engaging in and doing? Like, what would be your words to a group of pastors who are in the midst of that?
I have several thoughts. First of all, I think if a pastor is contemplating, say, I'm going to try to bring my church to a better place theologically, I think they need to be brutally honest in evaluating if they can do that. I mean, it's
like if they have the chops.
It's a good
themselves.
Idea, but can you do you even have a chance of pulling this off? Do you have that kind of clout, or are you just going to be out there on your own and they're just not going to come with you? I mean, I think you need to be realistic about it. Is what's going to happen, you're going to be fired? Is what's, you know, then maybe begin already to plan your exit strategy in a gracious, wonderful, beautiful, calm way. But if you do think, okay, no, I think I can, okay, then be slow with it. I mean, I would say, how long did it take us to transition Word of Life Church? I would say 10 years. The one, if people say, well, did you make any mistakes? Well, I mean, yeah, I made mistakes, but I don't know if I, the only one mistake I think that I would say, yeah, I wish I could have done that over again, was in the year 2006. And that was a year where I was just making such great discoveries theologically that I was trying to preach too close to what I was just learning. And so I was trying to bring my church just almost in stride with what I was doing, rather than have some distance between what you are learning and what you are preaching. It needs to assimilate for a while into you. It needs to be, it needs to become you. And I mean, for one thing, I was reading a lot of really hardcore academic theology, which I have a knack for, but that isn't how you should preach on Sunday, for crying out loud. And there was a space of time in 2006 where too many of my Sunday sermons would have been well suited for a seminary, but they weren't well suited for a local congregation on Sunday morning. And I look back, and again, that was a mistake made in good faith, but it was a mistake. So I would say, be patient. You don't have to tell it slant. You don't have to tell everything you know. If you're looking for people to change their mind in areas that are generally considered controversial, you can't just say, oh, we've always thought this, but now, bang, you're just going to meet resistance. What you do is you let, they have to connect the dots.
Mm-hmm.
They have to, now you can draw the dots fairly close, but they have to say, they have to have their own aha moment and see it. Now, if you do it that, when you preach that way, when you're, the final conclusion you leave to the congregation, one of three things is going to happen. One, they never connect the dots. Oh, well. Two, they connect the dots and see what you're saying and don't like it and leave. That happens. Three, they connect the dots and they go, oh, that's beautiful. And they continue on the journey with you. But they still have to, you can't just force it on them. I mean, I'll give you an example. I did, and I don't know who our listeners are. I don't know what they think about this, but I did in maybe 14, 15, somewhere in that, 16 maybe, I don't remember. I did a Lenten series called The Crucified God, which was, that's title stolen from Moltmann, but it was really, really what it was 6 weeks of giving people a way to look at understanding the death of Christ upon the cross in terms other than penal substitutionary atonement theory. But I preached that whole series and never mentioned penal substitutionary atonement theory. Never one mentioned it, never uttered those words. Never said, I know that you all think about the cross primarily like this, and I'm going to change that. I didn't do any of that. I just offered new ways of understanding how Christ's death upon the cross saves us. And I had like zero problem. Zero.
Yeah.
Because I was telling it slant enough. I wasn't hitting it head on. And a bit of advice. You need friends. You got to have friends. Probably, if I'm talking to pastors, you probably need pastor friends. Probably. I mean, there can be exceptions, but I don't, you know, pray and find them. But you need one or two or three. I mean, for me, that was right at that time. And it was just, I think it was God. That's when I met Joe Beach, pastor of Amazing Grace Church in Denver, and Bradley Jerzak. He's now an Orthodox theologian, the dean of St. Stephen's University in Canada. That's when we all met. And I mean, have I texted with them within the last, let's see, hour and a half? Yes. And we just remained friends, and you need that. There's going to be moments when you need your friends to rally around you and understand and be sympathetic and give you a shoulder to cry on or a kick in the rear or something, you know. And then the final thing is you need a prayer life. You need a prayer. If you're going to, you have to do this being sustained by a living, vital life of prayer. It's a must. And maybe, you know, because I think you maybe want to move in this direction a little bit, and it needs to involve some contemplative practices, because that's what will keep anger out of you.
So I want to talk to you in just a moment about contemplative practices, and maybe even if you're open to it, have you lead us through a contemplative prayer to end our time together? I'm kind of curious about, you talked about like people leaving the church. Your church had grown pretty large, and then it starts going through these shifts and people leave. So I assume that it's probably smaller than it had been.
Yes.
As churches make this shift into a space that's like, you've never considered yourself evangelical. You've made that, I think, pretty clear in several places. But in the sort of like post-evangelical space, we're seeing churches and pastors kind of move out of evangelicalism, and they're seeing church growth not happen in the same way that it did when they were in that space. I would be curious, like, what do you foresee churches being large churches again? Do you foresee this space being a space of smaller churches, like what sort of happens even in terms of like church size and expectations for pastors as to what their church looks like on the other side of this?
Well, and the other side of this meaning several things, meaning maybe a theological shift, but also other side of COVID, where I have not spoken to a single pastor who has said anything other than it looks like they ain't all coming back.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. Well, there will be big churches. I mean, they're all, you know, there just will be. This is America. And so there will be here and there. But I think there'll be anomalies. I think if we're talking in general, I think the future for Christianity in America is chastened. It's going to be, right now it's so toxically energized by the culture wars that it skews some things, but that will exhaust itself eventually. And what does the church look like on the other side of that? I think it looks chastened, humbled, smaller, and all of this change the world rhetoric needs to be lost. It's not our task to change the world. It's our task at best to be the world as being changed by Christ. Christ is the Savior of the world, not us. We're not. I mean, when we change, if we talk about changing the world, these lofty words, then the temptation to seize the most coercive and immediate methods of change, that is through politics, is almost irresistible. And then we sell our soul. And we may, quote, change the world. No, we actually end up becoming the world. Stanley Hauerwas says the first task of the church is to make the world, by which he means the first task of the church is to be something other than the world. I mean, if we're not something, you know, significantly other, then what is the point? So I think we're going to have to lean into willing to be counterculture, willing to be somewhat marginalized, willing to be smaller, chastened, humbled. I maybe some of it's stage of life stuff. So I mean, being 62 is not the same as being 22. But the idea of church growth, just hell, it just doesn't hold any allure for me. I mean, in and of itself. I mean, at any given point, you know, if I can have more than less, yeah, I'll choose the more. But as far as like being a primary drive, it's just not there. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in it. And then another tangential thought, which could be misunderstood. So I'm going to ask our listeners to, you know, try to engage with me in good faith and try not to misunderstand me. One of the things that has happened at our church is that we have pretty much erased the distinction between evangelism and discipleship. Evangelism, if you have a real hard divide, at least at this particular point in time, evangelism becomes get people to pray the prayer. And then, you know, so they go to heaven and not hell when they die and that sort of thing. Heaven and hell minimalism. But then you are tasked with forever trying to sell people on the optional upgrade of actually becoming a disciple. Mm-hmm. And they're not interested. So we just kind of see it as all one thing. We're inviting people to follow Jesus, whether they call themselves Christian or not. And then here's what could really be misunderstood. Because there are a whole lot of self-identified Christians that need to be evangelized. There's a whole lot of self-identified Christians that need to be saved. You know, I'm not talking about saved from hell when they die. I'm talking about saved from a tawdry, thin, cheap, unworthy distortion of Christianity. Now, how that can be misheard is, oh, you're just talking about, you know, proselytizing. I'm not, that, you know, that's not what I mean. I just mean there's all kinds of people, whether they self-identify as Christian or not, who need to be attracted to the beauty of Christ and begin to be drawn into that, where they say, I want to live out some of that beauty in my own life. So that's a big change.
That's good. Okay, so back to contemplative practices and prayer and the contemplative journey in all of this. It seems to me that one of the things that's missing in the larger sort of like a popular deconstruction conversation is movements of contemplative practice within that conversation. It seems like it tends to be a conversation of critique, of for some an intellectual journey, mm-hmm. but it misses this other piece. And one of my posits has been, that's a part of why we see the swing from being a fundamentalist conservative to just becoming a fundamentalist progressive, right. is you have the practices are what open up your heart in ways where you can look back on those previous experiences and appreciate them as opposed to demonize them.
Yeah.
It's what you talk about moving towards, I think, light and love. And it seems to me that the contemplative practices are a significant part of what helps you to move in that sort of direction. So you, I think you quote, do you quote Carl Rahner on the Christian of the future will be a mystic or he will not exist at all?
Yeah. And in fact,
do you mind
there's an entire chapter in the book entitled A Mystic or Nothing at All. So yeah, in 1971, Carl Rahner, a French or German Catholic theologian, says the Christian of the future will be a mystic. That is someone who's experienced something or they will cease to be anything at all. What Rahner called the future 50 years ago in 1971 is what we call today. We've already arrived at Karl Rahner's future. And that is, and I understand people, some people are put off by mystic or mysticism. As Christians, all we mean by mysticism is seeking and to some level attaining a direct experience within the mystery of God. And if that's what we mean, and it is what we mean, the Bible sets this forth as entirely normative. I mean, people are supposed to have experiences with God. People are supposed to hear God's voice. People are supposed to have an actual experience with God. I mean, that's the Bible just is like, yeah, that's go for it, man. That's what you were supposed to be happening here. And it's only been in, you know, in our enlightenment age of empiricism that we have sort of pushed that to the edge and forgotten that, no, at the heart of Christian faith is a revelation and an encounter with Christ himself. So, I mean, I would say certainly the most important thing I do as a pastor is to teach people how to pray. And, you know, you've seen what I do with the prayer school. I can't teach it to you right now. It really does take a minimum of 3 90-minute sessions. So, you know, I can't shorten it. But I will say at the heart of what I teach about prayer is contemplative prayer, or as I just call it, sitting with Jesus, but it is a form of contemplative prayer. But you can't just go directly for that. I think contemplative prayer must be sustained by formative prayer. By formative prayer, I mean when we are praying prayers that have been given to us through history, church, tradition, vetted by time, that have the capacity to form us in a right way. If we say, oh, I'm interested in this contemplative prayer thing because that's where maybe you can have a mystical encounter with God, that's what I want. I'm just going to go directly for that. I don't think you can get there that way. I just don't. I think you'll be disappointed. I think you'll find it frustrating. So the two go together. The structure of formative prayer houses within it the phenomenon of contemplative prayer, as I just call it, sitting with Jesus, where there's this, the possibility anyway, of a real encounter with the risen Christ. So I don't want to frustrate people. I mean, here's one of the things that came about, Mike, from COVID, was I always said I would not do a prayer school online.
Yep.
And then COVID came, and it was our staff really that urged me, says, you know, people are going to need this. You just need to let go of that and do it. And so the first one we did, we had 900 people.
That's amazing.
900 people. It's 900 computers, so a lot of them were couples, so it was a lot of people. And I've done since then, I've lost track of them. I know how many I've done altogether. I've done 85 or 86 prayer schools. But the next one, it's not, we have our staff meetings on Tuesdays. I don't know when this is going to air, but it'll be later on. But we're not even announcing it quite yet, but if people are just, you know, like, oh, I'm really interested, it will happen at the very end of February. I'll do 3 nights in a row. I think, you know, if you're in the West Coast, it'll probably be like at It's probably, it's started 6 p.m. It's be like 9876 across the U.S. And so just pay attention to me, follow me on Twitter or wherever, go to the WOLC.com website and it'll come up. I mean, we don't, it's, if there's a donate button, you know, so donate a dollar or whatever, and, you know, be a part of praise.
Donate more than a dollar.
Okay. But I mean, that's not the yeah. Well, that was one of my hindrances was, I said, I, if we just make it too easy, too available, I'm afraid people will view it as cheap. And it was my son, Aaron, says, that just require donation, but it can be anything they want to donate. And I said, okay. And so that's what we do now. I didn't mean this to be a pitch, because I've never done a pitch for Prayer School. I just always think that people that need it find it when they need to find it. But since I was talking about it, I didn't want to just frustrate people and say, well, you know, you have to have these formative prayers before you can even really enter into contemplative prayer. And they say, well, how am I going to get that? So I want to say that in February or in January, we're going to do an in-person one at our church. You can keep your eye out for that at the very beginning of January. The February one is right before Lent. It's going to be the Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday night before Ash Wednesday. You see how that works? And then you're ready to go into Lent.
Yeah. Yeah. And for whatever it's worth for folks listening, when you came out, I want to say you came out to Long Beach like 3-ish years ago.
Something like that.
Something like that.
3 or 30. And, I'm not sure.
yeah. Time is all relative right now. There is no such thing as time anymore. And you led a shortened version of what you were doing at the time. And I still hear from folks, just recently heard from somebody who told me, they said, hey, remember that prayer school that we hosted? I'm still utilizing the liturgy that you've created, and said like that it's just revolutionized, not just their prayer life, like it extends beyond your prayer time, right?
And I hear this.
It's a really
all the time, and I never am not amazed, because prayer school is not something I didn't ever intend to do it. I didn't sit down one day and say, oh, I need a prayer liturgy. It evolved organically over about 18 months, how I prayed, and then people began to ask me to teach them what they perceived was operating in my life, and one thing led to another, but I never set out to make it a thing. It just happened.
Yeah. Well, how about this? Instead of closing us out in a contemplative prayer, then would you happen to have available to you a received prayer that you would be willing to pray over our folks here? And while you're grabbing something or thinking of something, I'll just give one more pitch for your book is When Everything's on Fire, Brian Zond, Z-A-H-N-D. I would highly recommend it. And his previous books as well, Water to Wine, Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God. Fantastic books that I think are really helpful for the things that folks are wrestling through right now. So thanks. Yeah, thanks for being here and making time today.
Yeah, I think what I would like to pray, it's kind of a mixture. It's a prayer that I do pray every day, but it's the prayer that leads me into what I call sitting with Jesus. The background of this prayer is, I was on a personal spiritual retreat. I do this a couple of times a year at Conception Abbey, which is a Benedictine monastery about 35 minutes from me. And they have 65 monks. It's a pretty large monastery. And I show up twice a year, and I always tell them I'm their 66th monk. I tell Brother Cyprian, he's the guest master. I say, Brother Cyprian, I'm really good at being a monk. About a week a year. That's about it. But when I'm there, I'm in there at lauds and vigils and all their prayer times. But I was also receiving some spiritual direction from Father Daniel there. And he's one of the older, wise monks, also a priest that's been there for like 60 years. And he gave me some, he knows I like to walk. And so they have a 2.5 mile walking trail up there. And so he said, I want you to go walk this trail. And he told me some things to do. And while I was walking back on that trail, I wanted to pray St. Patrick's breastplate, but I didn't have it memorized. And it's, there's various versions of it. I had my phone. I could have looked it up, but I thought, hey, you know, I'm here not to do stuff like that. And so I just started, so I just kind of riffed on it and came up with my own version of it that I've been, that I've prayed every day since then, which has probably been, I don't know, 6 or 7, 8 years probably now. And so I'll pray it real slow because how I generally pray it, and people can probably write this down or they'll see how it works. And it goes like this. Christ, I acknowledge you. Christ above me, very God of very God. Christ below me, incarnate of the earth. Christ before me, when seen. Christ behind me, when unseen. Christ at my right hand in my strength. Christ at my left hand in my weakness. Christ all around me, filling all things everywhere with himself. Christ within me, formed by faith. And then I just sit with Jesus. When I say I sit with you, it's just silence. You say, well, what happens? That's what happens. I sit with Jesus. I acknowledge his presence above me, below me, before me, when seen, behind me, when unseen, at my right hand in my strength, at my left in my weakness. If you're left-handed, switch it. Christ all around me, filling all things everywhere. Christ within me, formed by faith. And then having acknowledged the presence of Christ, I sit in that presence because Christ himself is the salvation of God, the wisdom of God, the grace of God, the healing of God. And I just allow the wave after wave of all of that grace and wisdom and salvation and mercy just to wash over me and wash me clean and permeate me. And I sit in that presence. And so that's something you can do, and you can begin with that. And if you're interested in what a prayer school actually looks like, that'll come up at the end of February.
That's so good. Thank you, Brian. It genuinely was a real pleasure to get to chat with you again today.
Oh, it's good to see
you. Really grateful for you. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thanks for all that you're doing. You're doing really important work, and it's encouraging a lot of us.